We listed in December 2007. Neil Stewart was our chairman then, and I was the CEO. We raised a modest amount, $6.25 million at 25 cents. Apparently, I think we closed yesterday at 367. So if anybody's been with us the whole time, you've probably done okay. We started off with an empty salt lake, if I can put it that way. Nearest population would have been 30 kilometres to the northwest at Olaroz Chico. And the first thing you do is dig a hole in the ground to see if there's any brine there. We'd done some holes beforehand, so it wasn't a surprise. So the first program was a pitting program, and then followed up with a coring program. We thought it was going to be solid salt all the way through, like Atacama or Rincon, and so we started with a Longyear 38 and conventional methods, and found that after the first 3 metres we end up into soft sediments. So recovery for those geologists in the room was about 50% in the first program, and we had to develop new techniques to sample this challenging new environment. March 2009, we put out a scoping study and our first resource, 1.5 million tonnes, I think it was, a lithium carbonate equivalent. And that the pointers for that study was that this project was a good one and we should progress it. Back in 2008-2009, the world hadn't gone crazy on electrical vehicles. Our angle here was that the growth rate in the previous years had been 6 or 7% compound annual growth rate through 2000 based on portable electronics. And there's nothing wrong with 6 or 7% compound annual growth rate. Certainly electric vehicles was upside, but we were sort of more solidly founded on things that people used then and there. Anyway, so we found excellent chemistry, very attractive lithium grades and potassium grades, and what looked like a good business. So we progressed on. In January 2010, we signed an MOU with Toyota Tsusho, part of Toyota Motor Corporation Group. That MOU was basically what set us apart compared to all the other explorers at the time, because this MOU set a path through to development. It wasn't absolutely laid out. It wasn't, the numbers weren't clear, but there was a clear path to development. And Toyota didn't get any equity unless they financed the project with a debt package and actually purchased in. So all the numbers were conditional on things in the future, but it was a clear path. And what we didn't really understand at the time was that JOCMEC, which is our guarantor with the Japanese government, had kind of signed off at the time we did the feasibility study, and that got the financing away. So it's not just technical aspects in a project. What really counts is the ability to finance something. So there are other good projects in Argentina, and they will happen, but they missed that boat because they missed that financing window. So what separated us at that time was the ability for us to get a financing partner and get the project up and running. So this is a very important step, getting Toyota on board. January 2011, I just mentioned that as a key date. That's basically when the project got signed off, although it wasn't officially signed off until October 2012. And in the feasibility study, we just drilled out the top 200 metres. We hadn't done it all, and that was part of the strategy. The strategy was to get up and running and then develop more. So we did the minimum amount of work to get going, we got finance, and what the minimum amount of work still had was a 40-year project life and only extraction of 15% of the resources in that 40 years. So it was a pretty good minimum position, if I can put it that way. We'd actually had a pilot plant on site that was producing battery-grade material, so we showed it could be done with this brine, and we developed a pretty good technical team at that point in time. Market at that point in time was also, it was good, $5,000 a tonne, and this project stacked up on those numbers. We then got held up. So there's a lag time, as you can see, between May 2011 and 2012. The Jujuy government delayed our permits, created a position for a negotiation of a participation, and through that process in early 2012 became an 8.5% JV partner in the project. Why did it work that way? Well, they never even knew we were doing the work, really. We were low profile in the country. And we had an environmental approval for the development of this project at the back of 2010. So they got caught napping in a way. And why was it necessary? Well, until very recently, the royalty regime in Argentina was very, very low. The royalty regime that the provinces get is a 3% mine mouth value. So at the moment, we're paying about 1.2% of revenue, which, given the value of this product, is low and compares with what used to be in Chile, 8.5%. And if you look at the deal that Albemarle's done recently, much, much higher. So the politics was fair, if you see what I mean. The agenda was right, and we ended up with a partner that helped us a lot through the construction period. November 2012, construction began. There's a picture of our opening ceremony, a little local one. We had a more formal one at the end with the governor. August 2013, our first pumping from the bores. So the bores are out in the paddock or in the salt lake, pipelines to the ponds, and there's our first flow for Pachamama in the 1st of August 2013. Very important to get it done by Pachamama. That's a local festival. It was a good, what's the right word, omen for the project. Then the first commercial dispatch, April 2015, and we've been growing the project ever since that date. So Olaroz today, where is it? Well, we're in the lithium triangle, so-called lithium triangle, which covers part of Bolivia, southern Bolivia, eastern Chile, and western Argentina up the north there. This is an area which is very, very dry, so evaporation, net evaporation rate's very high, about 6 millimeters a day when you wind it back for the activity in the brine. There's been hot fluids that have come out of the ground and are trapped in basins. So the fluids don't run out to the sea, they stay in these trapped basins caused by the tectonic movements, and that's why these deposits are there. And the lithium has to be there first in the rocks to leach out and be deposited in these basins. So it's kind of unique in the world. There's only two other places with similar conditions, Tibet and a small part of the United States in Nevada. So very dry and those kind of conditions. So these deposits aren't found anywhere else but these areas. Argentina's become a more positive place to operate. We built this project at the time when there were importation controls, you couldn't access foreign currency to pay the bills, and it was pretty tough. But since the election of Macri, the place has become a normal place to operate. The peso's been floated, currency can flow in and out without any controls. And the government understands the importance of getting inflation under control. It's got its targets. It's not there yet, but it will get there. And it did the deal with the holdouts to bring its borrowing capacity into normal. After all of that effort, we've ended up as a profitable company. I say that with some mirth at the presentations I've been doing recently, because you'd have 7 exploration companies and then there'd be one that's actually making money. So production for the last quarter was down on the previous quarter, unfortunately, 2,784 tons. Our revenues were up 19%, with sales of 3,142, so $32 million in the quarter. Our sales prices were improving, so 13% up quarter on quarter to above $10,000 a ton. That's an FOB basis. That's what we receive in Argentina net of all costs. So this is not to be confused with delivered duty paid in China or CIF. So this is really the money we get in Argentina. High margin business, about 65%, so $6,646 a ton margin on production, up 21%, and we've got a good buffer of cash in the bank. At that point in time, $33 million. There have been funds that have come in from other transactions since that point in time, and we continue to be cash flow positive and topping up the tin at corporate level. As we equity account, there's some confusion about our debt levels, so if we disentangle all that and we look at our debt, you can see it's been going down strongly. We started paying back in September, two and a half years ago. So March 17 was our last payment. At that point in time, we had $155 million debt, down from the original $192. And that will continue at $10 million approximately every 6 months. So into our markets, there's a graphic of a solar park. The world's changed since we started this project. As I said, we were focused on things we knew at the time, and I was always a bit cautious at that time of promoting electrical vehicles, because it all depended on their take-up. At that point in time, if an electrical vehicle could do 60 or 80 kilometres, it was doing well. And there was a term around that time of range anxiety. And to my mind, nothing would happen if you had range anxiety. Anyway, the world has changed. Tesla changed the map by producing a vehicle with 300 kilometres range. And now we're talking about 300 miles range. And battery development is such that the weight of these batteries is the same for the same result. There's more lithium in them. They're cheaper to produce. I think when it had been about $1,000 per kilowatt hour for the batteries back then, and now we're down to $220. And the target is $80 per kilowatt hour. So just like solar panels, we're seeing the same evolution in technology in motor vehicles and batteries as well. And the objective is, for the manufacturers, is that, you know, when you walk into a showroom in the future, do you turn left for a conventional vehicle or right for an electric vehicle, because they're going to be the same price. So we're going to move to a different world where it won't be just on government incentives, you'll have the same cost for the vehicle. So that kind of enthusiasm is shown by, you know, what is on the drawing board for the manufacturers. And at the moment, you can count up 120 different EV models, either in production or on the drawing board, by 2020. Pricing has gone up, but in fact, the cost of the battery has gone down. And why is that? Because lithium carbonate is not that big a component. It used to be about 3%. Now, with declining battery costs, it will change, but it's still a very small component. Our rising price of doubling doesn't really have any significant impact on the cost of the battery. But for us, it's very important, of course. So we've seen rising prices. We had some older contracts to start with, things that have been set up in advance. But through the year, we saw rising prices, a little bit of a dip in the fourth quarter, and then above $10,000 a tonne in Q1. And that's being maintained through Q2. As was stated in the video, our analysis shows that current projects only have enough to support the baseline position of 2.5% EV penetration by 2020. That's pretty conservative. I had a meeting last night with someone who's involved in the downstream part of the business, and asked him what he thought EV penetration was going to be in 2020. Maybe he thought I said 2025, because he said 15%. Now, my comment to him was that 15% won't be able to be supported by the lithium supply in 2020. But there are views that are that strong. Roskills, who are the preeminent analysts in this sector, talked about 1 million tonnes of lithium carbonate demand in 2026. So we are coming from just over 200,000 tonnes at the moment. Traditionally, they've been conservative, so that was a real shock to most people at the conference in Montreal recently. So we need new projects. Those are the existing ones, the ones that are financed and being built or have been built, and we have our ramp-up curves in place there. But we need new projects to actually achieve the support of the more reasonable 3.5% line or even the 4.5% penetration line. You know, you need the Pilbaras, you need the Alturas to actually get on and develop their projects. But it's a tough life. And this goes back to my comment earlier on. Capital intensity is significant. You don't have an LME traded commodity. You have to produce a product of a certain quality. So if you look at the capital intensity and see, it's much easier for an existing producer to expand. That's no surprise to most people, but the numbers are supporting that. SQM's expansion, modest expansion at Atacama, should be online in a couple of years. Is the most least capital intensive. Our expansion, well, Olaroz would be the second, as would then the potential expansion of Cauchari after their phase one. If you look at the necessary capital for a hard rock producer, if it was to build its own conversion plant, then those are the most capital intense. But if you're a mining investor just going to look at a concentrate, then there's an opportunity there if you can partner with the right industrial partner in China, and they can take on that higher level of intensity. So let's focus a bit on our expansion strategy. We have a world-class resource at Olaroz, even in the top 200 metres. By the time we drill it down to 600 metres, which is what our geophysical work says is the bottom of the recent basin, and potentially deeper if there's brine in the underlying Sijes formation, it could be many times the size of the current 6.3 million tonnes. So our focus is to develop this asset, stay focused on this asset, and take it through multiple expansions, because that resource can support multiple expansions. We're a low-cost producer with a proven process route, so our risk is lower in our expansions, and the markets are growing strongly. So this is the asset that we're going to grow, with prudently timed expansions delivered to optimise shareholder value. So our first expansion takes us from 17,500 tonnes of production, battery-grade material, adding on another 17,500 tonnes, and our Japanese partners are running hard to build a 10,000-tonne lithium hydroxide plant in Japan to take some of the lithium carbonate and allow us to join the lithium hydroxide market. We had, as we started earlier, a number of other assets. We picked up a lot of acreage. So we thought to ourselves, how do we get value from those? Our focus is on Olaroz, that's enough for us. So how do we get value for these other assets? What we ended up doing is selling 50% of Cauchari and all the other assets to Advantage Lithium, and we stayed as a joint venture partner directly in Cauchari. We've ended up with 35% ownership of Advantage Lithium, and in effect a bolt-on exploration team for us. So they're working hard on that. They've started drilling already. We had the EIS approval ready for them. Following their $20 million capital raising, they've moved ahead. The first hole has been a successful hole in terms of its pointers towards brine at shallow depths underneath the Archie Barker Delta there. Some other assets we had at Salinas Grandes, we sold these to Stephen Dartel's LSC Lithium for $7 million and acquired back some very important bits of ground at Olaroz. So again, emphasising that focus on our core asset. We received the $4 million from that transaction recently. So in summary, constrained production in the June quarter. We're through the very quiet evaporation time of the year. It's the middle of winter. It's been snowing, lifting significantly into the first half of next year. And our production rate rides the evaporation rate from September onwards. We're a high-margin business, $6,500 a tonne approximately, and increasing levels of cash generation. June quarter pricing is expected to be above $10,000 a tonne. We've got plans to double production without raising equity, so this will be debt-funded through our current relationships and from cash flow. We have a 10,000-tonne per annum lithium hydroxide plant advancing in Japan, and as I said, expansion plans will be funded without new equity. The lithium market is a great place to be, and in our view will stay in deficit until 2021 at least. That view is concurred by Albemarle as well recently. They changed tune on that. They're talking about 2021 as a potential point of balance as well. So it's nice when the big guys support you. Anyway, so thank you very much for coming to this breakfast, and thanks for inviting us.